Really, I've wanted to see you and all, but I've been pretty busy since I got here, and I wasn't sure, you know, how you'd feel if I just showed up one afternoon. I would have felt right fine about it. It's not like I get many visitors out to the house. R.C. and Paul make dang sure of that, believe me. You of all people ought to know that I'd be hoping you'd show up. But I knew your grandpa had been sick and all, and that you were tending him. Still, you can't blame me for wishing you'd come and see me. It's been an awful long time, Hiram. She spoke without sadness, and seeing her smile and hearing her beautiful southern voice made me glad I'd come to the bridge that night. I have seen R.C. a few times, and I asked about you. R.C. Naomi rolled her eyes. I'd like to wring his neck. Do you know that he waited 2 whole days before he even told me you were in town? Not that I see him much anyways, with him working days and tomcatting around at night. But he should have been a little more thoughtful, and I let him know it, too. Naomi was the only person alive who could scold R.C. Rydell and get away with it. He hasn't changed much, has he? I mean, he's bigger and all, but he's still R.C. I almost told her what he had done to Emmett at the river, but I decided bad news about her brother wouldn't do her any good. She already knew, better than anybody, the kind of guy he was. I wish he'd turn over a new leaf, she said. He used to be just ornery, but lately he's been worse than that, almost like he's trying to get into trouble or trying to prove something. Sometimes I worry about him, Hiram, that he's looking for something he's never going to find. Enough about R.C. I'd had all I wanted of him lately. So, how's your dad doing? Naomi blinked when I said dad, but her expression didn't change. Fine, same as ever. Everything's just fine at home. Her voice was hard, firm. I knew she didn't want to talk about her father, so I just stood there looking at her, looking at the Yazoo, and neither one of us talked. Finally, she spoke again. Hiram, you ever want to get away? You know, just take a break from everything? Are you kidding? I've been trying to get back to Greenwood for 7 years. Sometimes my dad really bugs me, and for the last few years it seems like all we do is fight, so I couldn't wait to get away from home. And are you glad you did? I mean, has it helped any? I don't know. At first it was fun. Riding the train alone and all, visiting with Grandpa, seeing places and people I knew when I was a kid. But it hasn't been all fun. Some things have changed around here, at least they seem like they've changed to me. I'm not sure how I feel about that. Kind of disappointed, I guess. Have I changed? She smiled, her voice teasing me. Are you disappointed? You've changed all right, but believe me, I'm not disappointed. Good. She looped her arm through mine. I'll let you keep talking then. I remembered why I had always loved being around her. Naomi was so easy to be with, so comfortable. Most good-looking girls made me nervous, but being with Naomi seemed like the most natural thing in the world. Anyway, I've been thinking about things, about my dad and my grandpa. Those two never did get along, just like me and Dad don't get along. But I don't know, some stuff that's happened down here has made me wonder about Dad, kind of helped me think about him in a different way. Naomi leaned her head against my shoulder and sighed. You know, I'm dying to leave. Even if it's only for a little while. But I'm not like you. There's no place for me to go. R.C. can be a real headache when he's around, but at least he looks out for me. Always has. Lately, though, I can feel him pulling away, and I don't know what I'm going to do when he finally leaves. He's working and feeling more like a man every day, ready to be on his own. Pa can't see it, and he still treats R.C. like a kid, and sometimes, boy, do they battle. Her voice grew soft and sad again. It's hard to take. Awful hard to take. I slid my arm around her shoulders and hugged her. I'm sorry, Naomi. Truly sorry. She hugged me back, hard, but her body felt soft against mine, and her hair smelled fresh, like river water. After supper Friday night, Grandpa was reading the newspaper, and I was out on the back porch, hoping for a cool breeze. I'd been thinking a lot about Dad and Grandpa, about how the three of us were connected, even though on the surface we seemed to be pretty disconnected. My life felt like it had been tied into a giant knot, one that would take a long time to untangle. I was looking forward to going back to Tempe, because maybe I could finally talk to Dad, and we could start undoing some of the snags we'd gotten all caught up in. While I was sitting on the porch steps, R.C. crashed through the back bushes. My stomach tightened as he flicked his cigarette into the grass and sat down next to me.
Ain't seen you around town for a while, Hiram.
Been spending most of my time with Grandpa. That's what I came here for.
We sure had us a good time fishing Wednesday. You remember that?
Only thing I remember is you torturing that kid. Even though R.C. scared the heck out of me, I had to say something. Maybe he'd break my neck right there. Maybe he wouldn't. But I knew I wouldn't be able to sleep that night if I didn't finally stand up to R.C. Rydell. And I want to tell you something, R.C. I'm never letting you or anyone do stuff like that around me again. R.C. looked surprised.
What are you talking about, Hiram? All's I remember is that you and me went fishing on the Tallahatchie, caught us some fish, ate us some lunch, took a nap and headed home. Nothing else. Pa even remembers that string of fish I brung home.
Yeah, well, I remember something sick, something wrong.
Is that right? Well, Hiram, boy, don't go forgetting that you was there the whole time, and you're just as much to blame for anything sick or wrong that might have happened.
What are you talking about?
Sheriff Smith come round asking questions yesterday. Stuff about some black boy from Chicago. Old Mose Wright, the kid's uncle, complained that a couple local guys had been picking on the boy, and he remembered that one of them's name was R.C. Course, the sheriff don't put much stock in some strange niggers complaining, but he said it was his sworn duty to check out the boy's story. I told him I didn't know no strange niggers, and he knew I steered clear of colored folks anyhow. Just checking, he told me, just making sure no peckerwoods round here start any illegal violence. He told me to stay out of trouble and then left, and I've been wondering if he come to talk to you yet. I shook my head. Well, if he does, just you make sure you get your story straight. We don't want to be confusing poor old Sheriff Smith.
Look, R.C., if you're asking me to lie, forget it. I haven't seen Sheriff Smith, and I don't plan on seeing him. But if he comes around asking questions, I'm going to tell the truth.
R.C. swore and jumped to his feet. You little sis baby. I should have known you'd get all cry over that colored boy.
He looked mad enough to chew tar, and just when I expected an uppercut to my jaw, he smiled.
But hell, it don't matter none. Smith'll believe me over you. You ain't been around here for years anyway, and you're going back home pretty soon.
He patted me on the shoulder.
Guess I worried you over nothing, Hiram boy.
He lit a viceroy, and I got up to go back inside.
What's your hurry? Don't you want to sit around and visit with an old pal?
You got that right, R.C.
Well, then, I'm glad I came to say goodbye. One other thing. You hear about that trouble up in Money a couple days ago?
Trouble you're in the middle of?
Me? R.C. grinned. No, not me, least not yet. No, it's nigger trouble. Some strange nigger messed with a white woman up to Bryant's store.
What do you mean, messed with? He raped a white woman?
No, but the boy don't know his place.
Folks are saying he talked ugly and whistled at her. A married woman, even. The lady's husband was pretty upset when he heard about it.
asked me to go with him and some friends to visit the boy tomorrow night and teach him about how things work down here in the Delta.
Don't do it, R.C. I felt dizzy, scared like something terrible was going to happen. I swear, if you do anything, I'll...
Look at you, R.C. laughed. Don't get yourself all worked up for nothing, Mr. Sis Baby. I ain't stupid enough to come and tell you of all people right before I go and do something illegal. It's gonna be talk, nothing else. I'm just doing my citizen's duty to guarantee that white women are safe in our community.
I'll call Sheriff Smith, I mean it.
Go ahead, R.C. shrugged. Nothing to tell. We're just gonna talk to the boy.
He patted me on the head.
Night-night, Hiram boy. Hope you don't have no bad dreams.
R.C. walked across the yard and out through the bushes. When I came back into the living room, Grandpa was asleep in his chair, the Greenwood Commonwealth folded in his lap. I wanted to ask him if he'd heard about the trouble in money and to tell him what R.C. had said. I wanted to ask him what I should do. I almost woke him, but then I decided that I was 16 years old and could make up my own mind. I went into the kitchen and called the sheriff's office. My hand shook a little as I dialed the phone. Sheriff Smith wasn't there, so I ended up talking to one of his deputies. I told him everything R.C. had said.
"Ain't nothing to worry about, son," he replied. "R.C. Rydell's sure enough a troublemaker, but that's all he is. I don't expect that he'll even make it to money. He's too busy getting into mischief down here in his hometown to head up there."
"But he said he was going up there with some men because of that trouble at Bryant's on Wednesday."
"Know all about that. Colored round here been talking about it since yesterday. The word is that some Negro boy from Chicago made ugly remarks and then whistled at Ms. Bryant."
The deputy chuckled.
"Fool boy forgot where he was and what he was, and it's a fact somebody's sure to give that boy a talking to. It'll do him good to learn how things work here in the Delta."
A Negro from Chicago? Emmett. My heart thumped like it was going to rip right out of my chest.
"You don't understand. R.C. doesn't just talk. He's dangerous."
"Oh, he likes to think he's dangerous, but I've known him since he was a kid. Ain't gonna be no harm done, believe me."
"But I know R.C. and what he can do. Can't you at least go talk to him, or maybe pick him up tonight to keep him out of trouble? What if you send somebody by that boy's house, you know, to warn him, or send him back to Chicago right away?"
The deputy sighed.
"Look it, son, we can't be running all around the county for no good reason. Why don't you just let us worry about the law around here? There ain't gonna be no serious trouble, I can guarantee it. Now I gotta get back to work."
The phone line clicked, and the dial tone sounded like an alarm in my ear. Chapter 10. When I finally fell asleep Friday night, I dreamed that Dad and I were fishing somewhere on a gorgeous morning. The sun filtered through the trees and light reflected off the river like shiny scales, while we sat on the banks enjoying the peace and beauty of the place. Dad looked content and happy, not just with life, but with me. We weren't talking, but I could feel his love and acceptance. More than anything, more than even my next breath, I wanted to stay there at his side, to bask in the warmth of the morning sun and the security of his affection. He put an arm around my shoulders. It felt warm and strong, and real. I felt the weight of his arm and the movement of his ribs as he breathed. I'd never been closer to him. Then, for some reason, I stood up and left. I walked up a path away from the river to get something. Something that seemed important to me at the time, something I thought would please him. When I got back, Dad was gone. At first I didn't panic. I sat down exactly where we had been before and waited. I knew he'd return, and when he did, so would all the comfortable good feelings. Minutes passed. Dad didn't come back. As I sat alone on the bank of that river, the secure, loved feeling I had savored with Dad bled out of me, and a horrible emptiness replaced it. My heart ached for that feeling to return, but it didn't. I knew that moment with Dad was lost forever, and I sat on the riverbank crying for my father and for me. When I woke up, the ache in my chest lingered, and I felt lonelier and sadder than I had ever felt in my life. All day Saturday, I kept worrying about Emmett. If I thought I could have found his uncle's home, I would have driven out to warn him. I knew they wouldn't have a telephone in a sharecropper's shack, so trying to call him wouldn't have done any good. I felt lousy and helpless, and I said something to Ruth Ann about it while she was cleaning up after breakfast. She shook her head and frowned. I already heard plenty about his stupid stunt at that white man's store up in Money, and as soon as I see him, I'm going to give that boy a talking to he won't forget. It's thoughtful for you to be worrying about him, Hiram, but I'm sure Uncle Mose knows all about what happened, and he'll keep an eye on Bobo till they get him safe on that train back to Chicago. Later, Grandpa could tell I was worried about something, and he did his best to cheer me up, even took me fishing on the Tallahatchie, but that only made me feel worse. It reminded me of all the crap R.C. had done. I only went because I hoped I'd see Emmett so I could warn him and tell him I was sorry I'd let R.C. hurt him. But our fishing trip didn't last long because Grandpa tired out so fast, and we left the river without any fish and without seeing Emmett. On the way home, Grandpa said,
"You're still looking glummer than a lost puppy, son. Tell you what, we'll have dinner tonight at the Crystal Grill to cheer us up. No better place in the Delta for a good meal and good company."
That night, when we got to his favorite restaurant, Grandpa really perked up. Everybody in the place knew him. Some people patted him on the back as they passed our table. Others stopped to chat, usually about his work on the council and how they appreciated all he was doing to save the South. I hadn't seen him enjoy himself that much the whole time I'd been back in Greenwood. When we got home, Grandpa settled into his living room chair to read the Commonwealth, while I fiddled with the radio looking for a baseball game. I found a Dodgers game and lay on the floor listening to it until I dozed off. Sometime later, a knock on the door woke me up. Most of the lights in the house were off. It had to be pretty late, and Grandpa had already answered the door.
"Evening, Mr. Hilburn," said one man. "Sorry to be calling on you so late."
"Yes, sir, it is late," said another man, "but we gotta talk."
Grandpa looked back into the living room and saw I was awake.
"Council business, Hiram. Why don't you go on up to bed?"
Then, instead of inviting the men into the living room like he did with his regular council buddies, he stepped outside and talked to them on the porch, with the front light off, before coming back in to tell me he was off to another meeting.
"Don't wait up, son," he said. "This looks like it might take all night."
I watched him get into the back seat of their car and drive off, and then I went upstairs to bed. He must have got back pretty late because it took me a long time to fall asleep, and I never did hear him come in. The next day, Sunday, Grandpa and I both woke up feeling tired and lazy. The August heat and his diabetes had been wearing on him, and I was haunted by my worries about what R.C. might have done to Emmett the previous night. I made us a late breakfast, and we spent the rest of the day napping, playing cards, or listening to the radio in the living room. Seemed like neither one of us ever really got awake that day. I thought about asking Grandpa if I could use the phone to call long distance to talk to Mom and Dad, but I didn't know what I'd say to them if I did. I had a feeling that maybe Dad would call me, so I didn't mind hanging around the house all day waiting for the phone to ring. It never did. Grandpa felt better Monday morning, so after breakfast we drove out to the fields.
"Little fresh air is what we both need, son," he said. "Sitting around the house all day yesterday didn't do either one of us a bit of good."
As we drove to the fields north of town, I wondered if I should tell Grandpa about my fears that R.C. might have done something bad to Emmett. but he seemed so happy to be outside and to see that his crops were about ready to harvest that I didn't want to ruin his mood.
"Tell you what, Hiram,"
Grandpa said as we pulled away from the fields.
"Let's drive over to Indianola for lunch. There's a great little cafe downtown where we can get some catfish that's almost as good as Grandma used to cook."
He leaned back into the truck seat and swung his arm out the window and pointed forward.
"Drive on, boy. We're having us a day trip."
"Grandpa," I said as we headed up the highway, "did you and Dad ever fish together much, you know, when he was little?"
"Your daddy used to love fishing," Grandpa said. "He'd badger me all week to take him fishing on Saturday morning. He didn't mind getting up early. Didn't mind sitting still on the riverbank. Didn't mind spending a whole damn day in the same spot holding a fishing rod."
I could hardly believe what I just heard. Dad fishing? He'd never said a word about it. We didn't even own any poles. So when did he change? I mean, he's never taken me fishing.
"When your daddy got to be older, everything went crazy. He didn't want to go fishing, didn't want to have anything to do with me, and I don't mind telling you that his attitude rubbed me the wrong way. This was my only child. All my life I'd planned that we'd spend time together, fishing, working out in the fields. And when he didn't want to do that anymore, I started pushing him, making him go, making him do what I wanted him to do." He shook his head. "And that didn't do a damn bit of good except to push him away from me and my life. Don't get me wrong, son. Your daddy never gave us a lick of trouble. He got good grades, behaved himself in school, did everything right. But he wasn't doing it my way, and I let him know it. By the time he was in high school, we hardly talked anymore."
He sighed.
"And you yourself know that things haven't changed much since then.
Maybe they've even gotten worse."
"That's kind of what worries me," I said. "The same stuff is happening with me and Dad. Before I came down here, I didn't care about how we got along, and I didn't care because I thought he didn't care. But I don't like how things are with me and Dad, and now I'm starting to think that maybe he doesn't either. The problem is I don't know what to do about it."
"It can't be one way, I know that," said Grandpa. "To get connected, you both got to reach out. You've both got to be willing to give a little. My problem always was I wouldn't give an inch."
"Maybe Dad and I are too much like that. Neither one of us is willing to make an effort to understand the other."
"I'll tell you, son, that's one family trait I wish hadn't been passed on. There's lots in you that you, your daddy, or I can't do a thing about, but this is something you can change. And believe me, a good relationship between a father and his son is worth it. It's worth more than you can know."
"Grandpa, sometimes I wish that Dad and me could be like you and me." Grandpa looked sad when he heard that, and he said quietly,
"So do I, son. So do I."
When we got back home, there was a note on the door from Ruth Ann. It was written in her perfect, looping, cursive handwriting, and in the careful English she always used when she wrote something. "Dear Mr. Earle," it read, "I am truly sorry I cannot be at work today. My extended family has experienced a tragedy, and I must attend to their immediate needs. I shall do my utmost to be at work on time tomorrow morning. Please excuse my unavoidable absence. Very sincerely yours, Ruth Ann Parker."
"Good thing we had that big catfish lunch in Indianola today," Grandpa said as he handed me the note and opened the front door. "Grab the newspaper there, Hiram. Let's get inside and figure out what we can do to keep from starving until we see Ruth Ann again."
I picked up the Commonwealth off the porch and followed Grandpa into the house. When he got settled into his favorite chair, I handed him the paper and headed for the kitchen to put something together for dinner. "Scrambled eggs and toast okay?" I asked.
"Throw in a little onion if you can find it,"
he called over his shoulder as he snapped open the evening paper.
"Looks like we're going to survive after all."
I had just set the frying pan on the stove when Grandpa called for me. I switched off the burner and trotted back into the living room.
"Grandpa, are you all right?"
"Take a look at this," he said, handing me the paper. His face had turned serious and pale. Splashed across the front page was the headline, "Chicago Negro Youth Abducted by Three White Men at Money." I felt like I'd been kicked in the stomach. I skimmed the article. Emmett had been missing since early Sunday morning. Three white men and a woman had gone to his uncle's home and asked if the boy from Chicago was there. They took Emmett out to their car, where a white woman identified him as the one who had made ugly remarks to her, and then put him in the car and drove off. No one had seen Emmett since. The sheriff had already arrested Roy Bryant and J.W. Millam for the kidnapping, even though they claimed they had released Emmett, and was searching for a third man. "I can't believe this. I called the sheriff's office. I told them about R.C. I warned them that something like..." My voice choked up and I had to sit down. "It's R.C. They've got to know that. I told them Friday night."
"What are you talking about?"
Grandpa looked worried. "The third man. R.C. Rydell told me he was going to make trouble."
"Now don't go jumping to conclusions, son," said Grandpa. "Just because R.C. was talking big Friday doesn't mean he had something to do with this."
"But he told me he was going up to money with some other men. He said they were just going to do some talking, but I knew it wouldn't stop at that. I knew something bad was going to happen. I should have done more. I could have stopped R.C. I could have found Emmett and warned him." My whole body felt cold and hard, like a rock sinking to the bottom of a lake. Grandpa was about to say something when the phone rang. I went into the kitchen and answered it.
"This is Sheriff George Smith, and I'm wondering if I could speak to Hiram Hilburn."
"Yes, sir," I said. "That's me." I gulped. What had R.C. told the sheriff? Had he blamed me for what had happened?
"My deputy said you called here Friday night with some information about R.C. Rydell and his plans to call on a Negro boy Saturday night."
"Yes, sir."
"You seen R.C. lately?"
"Not since that night."
"He say anything to you about what he planned on doing?"
I took a deep breath. "He said he was going up to money with a couple other men to talk to a Negro boy about the trouble at the Bryant store. I tried to stop him. I didn't want anything to happen. I called your office and told..."
"Hold on, boy. You did just fine. Now, you got any idea where R.C. might be? He didn't say anything about where he might be heading, did he?"
"Last I knew, he was headed home." Sheriff Smith cleared his throat.
"I thank you, Hiram, for your help in this case. One more question. How long are you planning on staying in Greenwood?"
"I got a ticket for Wednesday's train. My dad wants me back in time for school."
"Well, you'd better call your daddy and tell him you're not going to be able to make that train. I'm afraid we might be needing you around here for the next little while."
Chapter 11. Grandpa didn't seem too worried about the sheriff's phone call.
"George Smith is all right," he said. "He's just doing his job. My guess is that when he finally catches up with R.C. Rydell, he's going to want you around to back up your story. You'll be fine, Hiram, I promise, and look on the bright side. We'll get to have a little more time together."
We talked for a few minutes. Then Grandpa went to the kitchen to use the phone. He dialed the operator and asked her to connect him with my parents' phone number. While I stood behind him waiting for the call to be put through, I wondered how Mom and Dad would take it. Would Dad even believe Grandpa, or would he think it was some kind of trick to keep me in Greenwood longer? I still felt cold and nervous. The thought of being the guy who got R.C. Rydell in big trouble with the police made me want to get out of Greenwood while I was still breathing.
"Hello, Dee," Grandpa said into the phone.
"This is Earl."
"Yes, calling long distance."
"No, Hiram is fine, but there is some complication just now."
"Is Harlan home?"
"I see."
"Well, there's been some mischief down here.
None of it Hiram's doing, of course, but the sheriff is in the middle of tracking down some of the troublemakers, and he might need Hiram here to confirm a detail or two. No, no, it's nothing serious at all, just a hot-headed kid acting stupid. Of course, Hiram is welcome to stay here, you know that. I'll take good care of him until this whole thing is over. Then I'll make sure he gets on the next train for Arizona. Yes. Yes, dear, I will.
Grandpa handed me the phone.
She wants to talk to you.
Hiram? Mom sounded worried. You're not in trouble, are you? It's like Grandpa said. The sheriff just wants me to stick around in case I have to answer questions or something. I'll be all right.
Your father's not going to be pleased when he hears about this. You know how he feels about Greenwood.
We'll tell him that being here has helped me appreciate what he's been saying all along. I still love it here and love being with Grandpa, but I think maybe I understand Dad a little better now. At least I hope I do.
Do you need me or Dad to come out there? One of us could be in Greenwood in a few days.
I'll be fine with Grandpa, and I'll come home as soon as I can. Everything'll be okay.
I tried to say that like I believed it.
Just you remember who you are, Hiram Hilburn, and be sure you do what is right no matter what, and help your grandpa as much as you can. You're not there on vacation anymore.
Thanks, Mom.
I love you, son.
Love you, too, I said before I hung up.
Later that night, Grandpa talked to Sheriff Smith on the phone just to make sure he understood everything that was going on. He told me about the call before we went to bed.
George thinks this might go to trial. And if it does, and if it turns out R.C. was involved with those Peckerwoods, he'll need you to testify. He's got other evidence, of course, but your story will help place R.C. in the picture. I told him I didn't think involving you in this whole mess was necessary, but he insisted on keeping you around. I tell you one thing, Hiram, if R.C. Rydell is involved in this, he's in deep trouble. This isn't bullying. They're after him for kidnapping. George thinks R.C. might be holding that Negro boy somewhere right now. There's no telling what he might have done.
That's exactly what I was afraid of.
Ruth Ann showed up to work the next morning looking exhausted. She'd been out to Emmett's uncle's home trying to offer what help she could.
Uncle Mose is sick with worry, she said. Those white men came into their home in the middle of the night with a flashlight and a gun and demanded to see Bobo. Uncle Mose begged them to leave him there. He promised he'd give Bobo a good licking himself, but they wouldn't listen.
Her eyes glistened with tears.
They made the boy get dressed and dragged him out to their car, and nobody's seen or heard from him since.
Ruth Ann held back a sob, but her voice quivered when she said,
"That poor boy and his mama. This is plain awful."
The next evening's paper had little to say about the kidnapping. "Negro Youth Still Missing," read the front page headline. The short article summarized the details in the case, including that the police were still looking for a third man and that they were conducting intense searches for Emmett up around money. I wondered if they'd find R.C. I wondered if they'd find Emmett. Wednesday evening's paper answered one of my questions. They found Emmett. Missing Chicago Negro youth, found in Tallahatchie River. August 31, 1955. The body of a 14-year-old kidnapped Chicago Negro boy was found floating in the Tallahatchie River this morning. Discovery of the body was made by a young fisherman named Mims, who was inspecting his trot line. The body was in shallow water near the bank, it was reported, and was found at Pecan Point, near Philip. Young Mims notified Sheriff H.C. Strider at Charleston in Tallahatchie County of his find. He immediately called the sheriff's office in Greenwood and reported the matter. Deputy Sheriff John Ed Cawthron and Deputy Sheriff Ed Weber went to the scene and carried Mose Wright, uncle of the youth, along in order to make identification of the body. It was brought back to Greenwood and turned over to the Century Burial Association, local Negro undertakers. Officers said that the body had been weighed down with a cotton gin pulley tied with barbed wire. There was also a bullet hole in his head. Three white men and a woman took the boy from his uncle's home early Sunday after the boy allegedly made ugly remarks to a white woman. Two white men, Roy Bryant and his half-brother J.W. Millam, have been charged with kidnapping. The sheriff's office said that an additional charge of murder will be made since the turn of events. Sheriff George W. Smith said several days ago, after the happening, that he was afraid of foul play. Young Till allegedly made the ugly remarks to Mrs. Bryant, wife of the storekeeper who faces a kidnapping charge. The youth was visiting his uncle, Mose Wright, a tenant farmer. Sheriff Smith said Bryant admitted taking the boy from his uncle's home, but said the youth was released when Mrs. Bryant said he was not the boy who made the remarks to her. Sheriff Smith said the investigation showed young Till and several other Negro youths went to the Bryant store in the Money community, and Till went in and allegedly made the remarks. Early Sunday, a car carrying three men and a woman drove up to Wright's house. One of the men asked Wright if the boy from Chicago was there. Two men brought the boy out of the house. Wright asked where they were taking his nephew. One of the men replied, "Nowhere, if he's not the right one." When I put the newspaper down, my hands were shaky and cold. Emmett was dead, murdered. The article said nothing about R.C. Rydell, but I figured the sheriff must still be looking for him. Was R.C. involved in the murder? I knew he was, and I hoped the police would find him soon. And what about Naomi? If R.C. skipped town or ended up in jail, she'd be left alone with her dad. I didn't even want to think how much more miserable her life might become in that shack down along the Yazoo. Grandpa interrupted my thoughts when he whistled softly after reading the article. "I can't believe they killed that boy." He rubbed his hand across his face and muttered to himself, "There's going to be hell to pay now." He still looked pale as he folded the paper on his lap, creased it carefully in half, and set it on the table next to his chair. "Hiram, those boys went too far, way too far. For his sake, I sure hope your friend wasn't involved in this mess. I never did think much of R.C. Rydell, but I never took him for a murderer." "R.C.'s not my friend, Grandpa," I reminded him without looking at him. "I told you how he acted." "Of course he's not your friend. A Hilburn usually has better sense than getting mixed up with people like these." Grandpa rapped his knuckles on the folded newspaper. "People all over the United States are hearing about what's happened down here and wondering what kind of uncivilized brutes live in Mississippi. Those Peckerwoods who did this are ashamed to all of us in the Delta. No self-respecting Southern gentleman would lower himself to go this far." Grandpa's reaction bothered me. He seemed more concerned about the negative press than about what had happened to Emmett Till. He kept on complaining. "The radio said that colored boy's mama up in Chicago is blaming everyone in Mississippi for what's happened. Said she said, the entire state of Mississippi is going to pay for this. The woman's grief is understandable, Hiram, but she's got no cause to blame all of us for what a couple redneck Peckerwoods did in the middle of the night. Before we know it, the NAACP and all those bleeding-heart Northerners are going to use this as another excuse for integration. They're going to come down here and cry about how we treat our Negroes and how we've got to mix the races in our schools. That's what really makes me mad, son. Those ignorant boys have stirred up a hornet's nest of trouble."
"But what about Emmett?" I asked. "They killed him. Doesn't that make you mad?"
"Of course, those boys went too far. Whatever that colored boy deserved, he didn't deserve getting shot and tossed into the Tallahatchie, that's for sure."
I wanted to yell at Grandpa.
A boy was murdered just for acting cocky. I wanted to say something, something mean and hard that would knock some sense into him, but I knew nothing I could say would change him, and I had a glimpse into why Dad and Grandpa never got along. "Mr. Hiram," called Ruth Ann from the front door. "You got a visitor?" I left Grandpa sulking in his chair and went to the front porch where Ruth Ann stood talking to Naomi. Naomi had her head down, as she always did when she spoke to adults. "Ms. Ruth Ann," she said, "I just want you to know how awful sorry I am for what's happened to your cousin's nephew. It's an evil thing, a terrible, hateful thing." A tear rolled down her cheek, and Ruth Ann hugged her. "Now thank you, honey," said Ruth Ann. "Lord knows it surely does help to share grief with somebody else." She sighed and let go of Naomi. "Child, I do appreciate your sympathy, but you didn't come here just to talk to me. I'm heading on home anyway, so you and Mr. Hiram can sit out here and talk if you like." Naomi nodded and sat in the porch swing while Ruth Ann stood there looking washed out and exhausted. I remembered how I had felt when Grandma died and wondered how Ruth Ann was feeling. Emmett's death had been a surprise, just like Grandma's had been, but his was a brutal murder, not a quiet slipping away in the middle of the night. "Ruth Ann," I said, "I feel terrible about Emmett. I don't know what I can do or say. I wish I could have. I'll remember him and his family in my prayers." "Thank you, Hiram. We'll all be praying, too. Praying for the good Lord's mercy." "Good night, you two," she said and went down the front steps. When she had gone, I sat next to Naomi. "I can't believe it, Hiram," she whispered. "They killed that boy. When I think about how he must have felt, what he must have been thinking those last hours, how afraid he would have been." She shivered. "Why do men do things like that? Why do they have to hurt people?" I had no answer, so we sat without talking as our swing rocked gently in the late August breeze. Even though the horrible things that had been done to Emmett filled my head, it was comforting to be with Naomi. Like Ruth Ann said, it helps to have someone to share grief with. After a few minutes, Naomi leaned her head on my shoulder and said, "I feel awful, and I'm just so scared." For the next 2 days, Greenwood hummed with talk about Emmett Till. Some wondered who the third man might be. Others hoped Bryant and Millam got the full punishment of the law. A few thought Bryant and Millam had done nothing wrong.
"Nigger boy should have knowed better," I overheard someone say at the River Cafe. "I'm mighty glad we still got men in the Delta who won't put up with uppity niggers from the North. Maybe that message'll get around."
That night, Grandpa pointed to a front-page article he had just read in the Commonwealth.
"They got that right," he said. "Got it dead right. Listen to this, Hiram."
Grandpa read the article aloud, sounding as dramatic as a radio announcer.
"A just appraisal, an editorial. September 2nd, 1955. The state of Mississippi and LaFleur and Tallahatchie counties in particular have been brought into the focus of national attention within the past few days as a result of the brutal murder of Emmett Lewis Till, a 14-year-old Chicago Negro boy. This deplorable incident has made our section the target of unjustifiable criticism, thoughtless accusations, and avenging threats. We can understand the heartbreak of the mother of the dead boy, and we offer our sympathy and express our deep regret that this terrible thing has happened to her. But her determination to see that Mississippi is going to pay for this, charging the entire state with the guilt of those who took the law into their own hands,
is evidence of the poison selfish men have planted in the minds of people outside the South. If the mother had expressed the determination to see that the guilty parties must pay for this crime, she would have expressed the sincere desires of the people of Mississippi. The NAACP has only revealed again its blindness and injustice in charging that Mississippi has decided to maintain white supremacy by murdering children, and that the killers of the boy felt free to lynch him because there is in the entire state no restraining influence, not in the state capital, among the daily newspapers, the clergy, nor any segment of the so-called better citizens. From its headquarters in New York, it has charged every citizen of the state with being an accomplice in the crime. On the basis of one murder, it has judged the character, honor, and integrity of the entire population. One wonders why it did not judge the people of our state by the incident of a few months ago, when a 10-year-old white girl in the same community risked her life in the same river, only a few miles from where the body of the 14-year-old boy was found, to save the life of a Negro woman who was drowning. The citizens of this area are determined that the guilty parties shall be punished to the full extent of the law, and that justice shall be administered irrespective of the color of the victim or the criminals. The greatest enemies of this justice are the outside groups and individuals who chill the flames of indignation aroused by such crimes by wholesale and indiscriminate accusations against the law-abiding and justice-loving people of our state. If the NAACP and other groups want justice, then let them cease throwing stones at the prosecution, judge, and jury. If they're as concerned about this matter as they claim, then let them judge the evidence in the case and cease using the case as manufactured evidence to wage war against segregation. The people of Mississippi are no more responsible for this tragic murder and no more condone it than the people of New York or any other state are responsible for and condone murders committed there. But every decent and respectable citizen of this state will assume his or her responsibility for seeing that justice is administered through the courts of law and that guilty parties shall pay for their crime. He set the paper down. See here? We can't be blamed for the sorry actions of a couple local hotheads who haven't got an ounce of common sense between them. Those boys, being from Mississippi, shouldn't condemn the whole lot of us, just because we believe in segregation, in the inequality of the races. Or just because we might even know a couple dumb peckerwoods from the next county doesn't make us evil. Those boys did the killing, not me, you, or the entire state of Mississippi. He shifted in his chair, looking like he'd made up his mind about something. No blame here, no sir, and I don't care what that boy's mama or the NAACP say about it.
But what about R.C., Grandpa? The paper's been saying that there was a third man involved in it.
The law'll take care of him. Sooner or later, R.C. Rydell's going to end up in a bad way, Hiram. If he doesn't get hung for this, it'll be something else down the road. The boy's got bad blood, and that's all there is to it. And Hiram, I've been thinking about this, and it seems to me there's no need for you getting mixed up in this mess. R.C. has dug his own grave. My guess is that once the sheriff catches up with him, things will be plain as day and you won't need to say anything about anybody. You'll be on your way back to Arizona before you know it.
I hoped Grandpa was right. But I knew that if I did have to say anything to Sheriff Smith about R.C., I'd be lucky to get out of Greenwood alive. Chapter 12. Most of the next day, I fretted about what to do. Had R.C. heard that I'd talked to the sheriff? Was he looking for me? If he was, would he come at night, catch me in the backyard when I wasn't expecting him? Would he pull me into an alley when I was downtown? Would he be hiding out near one of my fishing holes, waiting to ambush me? Or would he be crazy and cocky enough just to walk up to the front door and knock? When we were kids, I figured R.C. was plain mean.
but after what happened to Emmett, I knew R.C. was worse than mean. For the first time in my life, I worried about dying, not just the death part, but the messy and painful things that would lead up to the dying, the kinds of things that would make a guy welcome death. I wanted to forget the sheriff's orders, pack up my things, and jump on the next train out of Greenwood. Early that evening, while Grandpa was dozing in his chair and I was flipping through old magazines, trying to keep my mind off the trial, torture, death, and R.C. Riddell, a loud knock on the front door just about pushed my heart right through my chest. I didn't move. Grandpa's snoring paused a moment, but he didn't wake up. The pounding again. "Grandpa?" I whispered. "Grandpa, somebody's at the door." He was dead asleep. More pounding. "R.C.?" My mind raced to figure out what to do. Grandpa's pickup sat in the driveway, so it was obvious we were home. I could wake Grandpa, but he'd be no good against R.C., and if he got in the way, R.C. would probably hurt him too. I could sneak out the back, but that'd mean leaving Grandpa alone. Believe me, I'm no hero. But right then, I realized that as long as I was in Greenwood, R.C. could get me if he wanted to, and I'd have to face up to him sooner or later. I took another look at Grandpa, asleep. "I'll get it," I said, even though he couldn't hear me. It was still summer, but my hand felt ice cold as I gripped the knob to open the door. It was like opening my own coffin. I took a deep breath, turned the handle, and braced myself for a fist smashing my front teeth. Where I had expected to see R.C. Riddell ready to rip my head off stood a uniformed deputy. He had a clipboard and some papers in his hand.
"You Hiram Hilburn?"
Slumping against the doorway, I tipped my head back and let out a sigh.
"Look at here, boy," the deputy snapped. "You Hiram Hilburn or not?"
I stepped through the front door and pulled it closed behind me.
"Yes, sir."